And this is Jesus calling out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. While Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked Jesus to dine with him. So Jesus went in and reclined at table. The Pharisee was astonished to see that he did not first wash before dinner. And the Lord said to him, "Now you Pharisees, you cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You fools! Did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. But woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb, and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, for you are like unmarked graves, and people walk over them without knowing it." One of the lawyers answered him, "Teacher, in saying these things you insult us also." And he said, "Woe to you lawyers also, for you load people with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. Woe to you, for you build the tombs of the prophets, whom your fathers killed. So you are witnesses, and you consent to the deeds of your fathers, for they killed them, and you built their tombs. Therefore also the wisdom of God said, 'I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute, so that the blood of all the prophets shed from the foundation of the world may be charged against this generation, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, it will be required of this generation. Woe to you, lawyers, for you have taken away the keys of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering.' As he went away from there, the scribes and the Pharisees began to press him hard and to provoke him to speak about many things, lying in wait for him to catch him in something he might say." And we're doing the first three verses of chapter 12. "In the meantime, when so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were trampling one another, he began to say to his disciples first, 'Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Nothing is covered up that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in private rooms shall be proclaimed on the housetops.'" Okay, this passage is about hypocrisy. Now, we deep down hate hypocrisy. And hypocrisy is all over the place at the moment. I don't know if you've caught, well, you've probably seen this blocking your journey to work, but the kind of Extinction Rebellion, encouraging a faster reaction to climate change, good thing to do, it seems, maybe not the right tactics, but Emma Thompson has got caught in a backlash around hypocrisy because she came in to speak to the climate rebellion people. And the problem is that she flew in all the way from LA, so 5,400 miles of extra air pollution caused by her journey there and back to speak there. And when asked if she flew economy, Dame Thompson said, I bloody don't know. I'm far too old for that. So that's £3,325 that could have gone to help fight climate change. And obviously flying first class means fewer people are journeying because there's they're taking up more room on the plane. So it's even more climate negativity. Hypocrisy, that's what she's been called out for this week. And there she was speaking from the bus saying, "Tell the truth." We know it in the wharf as well. So the buildings are all shiny. It looks so good on the outside. Corporate values emblazoned everywhere. Yet there's that's not always been the story inside the organizations. So you've got the big four auditors who can't audit their own auditors. So the Carillion collapses and it turns out they've not been doing the auditing job well enough. Banks demand people be careful with their money when they're not careful with their own. Hypocrisy, we instinctively hate it, and it's out there in society, and it's inside the church as well. Church leaders greedy for money, while congregations need to sacrifice for Jesus. church leaders demanding sexual purity, and then running off with the organist, or whatever it is. Good news. Jesus hates hypocrisy even more than we do. And he wants to unmask hypocrisy for us here this morning. And he wants us to show how much God hates it. And yet he wants us to see the solution to hypocrisy too. So hypocrisy is the issue. So if you look down at 12 verse 1, you'll see it there. Beware the leaven of the Pharisees, the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. The word hypocrisy comes from a Greek word about the masks that people used to wear when they were acting on stage. So to inhabit the character, they used to just put the mask on. They look like one thing on the outside, but underneath they're someone different. And they can just switch the mask if they need to play a different character for a different crowd. That's what hypocrisy is. This passage ultimately defines hypocrisy as the difference between the mask we wear before others and God, the difference between that and the reality underneath. You see on the sheets there an outline of where we're going. It said hypocrisy is unmasked. First thing, we're not to be deceived by appearance. That's what Jesus knows. So verse 37, the Pharisee invites Jesus to dine with him. We've seen lots of disciples doing that. The Pharisee looks good on the outside. And yet that doesn't mean that what looks good on the outside is actually good on the inside. I'm not sure if it's good or if it's evil disguised as good. Jesus, he sees it. He isn't deceived. And the Pharisee pulls Jesus up on why he hasn't done the right ceremonial washing before eating. So that wasn't an actual Old Testament law. It was an extra rule the Pharisees had thought up to try and encase and make sure they were keeping some of the Old Testament laws. An equivalent might be something like saying grace before a mealtime today. So there is no command in the Bible to say grace before you eat. I mean, there are lots of good reasons in the Bible why you'd want to. There's no command to do it. And Jesus knows this guy is so about outward performance, he picks a fight. He deliberately starts his meal without saying grace. Deliberately starts his meal without going through the ceremonial rigmaroles of washing. And the response unmasks this Pharisee. He is astonished that Jesus did not do that. How dare you start without saying grace? Don't be deceived by appearance. Jesus isn't. Second, don't fixate on externals. That's what the Pharisee is doing, is fixating on externals. So verse 39, they cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish. So they make the mask look beautiful. But the inside, the internal, is what matters. So verse 39, inside you're full of greed and wickedness. Fools, did not he make the outside also make the inside? There's a disfigurement that lies behind the mask. The mask makes them look good. Underneath, full of greed and wickedness. Jesus hates greed and wickedness. The Pharisees are so wicked, they end up killing Jesus. Jesus sees past the mask. So verse 42, you tithe the mint and the rue and every herb. You're so careful, but Jesus sees the heart doesn't love God. Verse 44, they're people who are like an unmarked grave. People don't even know that they're walking past something that in the Old Testament would cause uncleanness and infectious decay before God. Fixation on externals is all over this passage, and it's all over society too, isn't it? People who want to jump on the hashtag MeToo bandwagon and tweet their horror at what others have done. But behind the scenes, well, there's still the same people objectifying women behind the scenes, in their room on their own, still watching pornography. People who look good raising money for charity and posting that all over social media, but they're still living in pampered luxury, spending thousands that they could be giving to help others. Church, in some circles, it's, well, as long as I shop on a Sunday... don't shop on a Sunday, sorry. I look good. The external is right. Behind the scenes, I'm just out for myself. Or, oh, I never touch a drop of alcohol. Or I turn up to church and growth group every single week. The mask is looking good. Who cares what's behind the scenes? This passage is a declaration of what Pharisees are like. So these religious leaders, this is exactly what they were like. But it's also a warning to disciples not to become like them. So 12 verse 1, do not let the leaven, the yeast of the Pharisees, work into your bit of the dough. This needs to be an active thing because as you mix bread together, the yeast does normally get everywhere. You've got to actively stop and resist this deep down temptation to hypocrisy. We're so proud, we love to show off to others. We've got to fight this. Out of this fixation with externals flow some other obsessions. So in verse 42, Jesus says they major on the minors. They major on the minors. Verse 42, you tithe mint and rue and every herb. I don't know how they did this. Maybe they harvested it and weighed it. I like to think they were sort of there kind of measuring their plant. Okay, oh, it's grown 10 centimeters since last time. Okay, 1 centimeter. Were their measurements accurate enough? Who knows? They're desperately trying to make sure that they've kept the Old Testament law to tithe literally everything you could possibly think of. That's what they're majoring on. But verse 42, no, the majors are the majors. You neglect justice and the love of God. So maybe there's this traditional church flower lady who is absolutely obsessed with the perfect bunch of flowers being there at the front of church every single week. But the idea of giving up on the grudge she's been carrying for 30 years, no thank you. Or here's the musician, not these guys this week. I'm absolutely obsessed with getting the chord progression right between the two songs, like practicing desperately, desperately trying to get that right. But just not caring about their affair. I'm not bothering to look at that. Majoring on the minors and minoring on majors. We're not to fixate on externals. We're not to major on the minors. And we're not to just put on a performance. So they fixate on the externals, fixate on the mask, because they're all about the performance on the stage. They're all about what other people see when they look. So it's the kind of tie-masked pantomime. They've just got to get that performance perfect. Who cares what's underneath? They're performing in front of others, so it says, woe to you Pharisees in verse 43. You love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. You name it, you think of it, somewhere in the world, under the mask of Christianity, utter evil has taken place. I was hearing the other day about a kind of big man in a church in Uganda, the richest guy in the village, parading to the front of church every single week, making sure everyone can see him, making sure everyone sees how much money he gives, and abusing his young nieces the rest of the week. You name it, it has happened in the name of, under the banner of Christianity. These guys, Jesus says, woe to. And disciples must beware putting on a performance. Is that a bit of yeast beginning to work into our lives and our hearts? Why did we come to church today? Why are we wearing what we're wearing today? Why did we say what we said in that Bible study today? Why am I preaching today? Is it because it's an overflow of a heart that's trying to love God and be humble? Or is it because I just want to look good and put on a performance before others? Do we pray sincere-sounding prayers in groups, but never actually pray on our own? It's worth kind of stepping back a little bit from the passage and thinking, why do they prioritize performing in front of others? Why do they do that? Ultimately, I think it's because they're picking a judge they think they can fool. They're picking a judge they think they can fool. So deep down, humans realize God sees everything. We know we can't fool him. Instead, we choose a different courtroom. another one in front of others from whom we can successfully hide our guilt. So if you want to be lazy with your next business presentation and you've just come together with like a really, really rubbish set of presentations and you've just kind of rushed it off, it's just you brain dumped. If you can't be bothered to work harder, well, what you can do is just go to your nan or something and say, "What do you think of my presentation, Nan?" And she'll go, "Oh, lovely, the technology seems so great. Don't worry, go for it." You can fool her, but if you go to your expert colleague who knows that you've just cut all the corners and mucked it up and you've not bothered, you can't fool them. That's what the Pharisees are doing. They're going to humans who they can fool instead of realizing that, no, our performance, the performance that ultimately matters is the one before God who we cannot fool, who sees our successes but sees our failure. If we want to kid ourselves we're good enough on our own, well, we need to make humans the judge. They're the ones that can't see what's underneath. One way of diagnosing this is whether we're beginning to fall into this ourselves is how much we care when we think our masks might be slipping. So if God's opinion of us is what truly matters to us, if that's what we care about, well, then when other people see behind the mask and see the failure there, see the sin there, we'll go, "Oh, okay, yeah, no, that's me. I know I need forgiveness. I need your help. Please help me. Please pray for me." There'll be a community of people who want to help each other come to Jesus for forgiveness and come to the Holy Spirit for the power to change. But if we're living all about the mask and all about performing in front of others, we'll never let the mask down. We'll never let other people see our failure. And if people do start to see it, well, then we'll get angry or get distraught or we'll storm out and we'll leave. No, don't fixate on externals. Don't major on minors. Don't put on a performance. In verse 45, Jesus turns his guns from the Pharisees onto the lawyers. And we'll see his big charge against them is that they burden others. Don't burden others. Given how many lawyers there are in the room today, we could have a lot of fun with this, couldn't we? We could tell some lawyer jokes. I don't know. What do you think when you see 25 lawyers buried up to their chins in cement? Not enough cement, maybe. We won't do that, though, because they're not funny jokes. And they get me in trouble with Fiona. Partly because they're not funny, partly because I'd lose the slander case, but mostly because that's not what this passage means by the lawyers. Instead, these are a wider group of Pharisees. They're the professional Pharisees. So the Pharisees were a wider group, but they had a day job. These guys' job is full-time to interpret the law. They've got a slightly different mask, but it's the same ugliness behind it. Lawyers fixate on externals too. So verse 47, they build the tomb of the prophets. There they are. They're celebrating the right people. They're celebrating God's people. But verse 47, these prophets, your spiritual fathers killed. It's so easy to just end up trying to rejoice in the right people, but actually living in opposition to what they and what God stood for. So somewhere today in the world, there'll probably be someone parading round a church called St. Paul's, but living in opposition to what St. Paul actually taught. Denying judgment, denying the cross, denying the resurrection, denying basic biblical morality. They're fixated on externals. They like to put the tag on, but they're not living and listening to the people whose tagline they're trying to live under. They fixate on externals, but in verse 46, they burden others. They burden others. Here you go. Nice picture of a burden. Verse 46, woe to you lawyers also, for you load people with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. So as religious professionals, paid for by the rest of society, they've got all the time in the world to make sure they tithe their mint and their rue exactly right. To make sure they've got they don't need the energy so they can sit around and fast all day. They've got the money from others, so tithing isn't a problem. They take the outward performance for themselves, and then they insist that other people live up to the same performance. And they don't lift a finger to help. So MPs tell the country to... some MPs tell the country to keep tightening their belts, but can't tighten their own. So 46 MPs own second homes in London, but together spent more than £1.3 million on rent or hotels in the last year, while telling others to tighten their belts. Or you can see it sometimes in the practice of Ramadan inside Islam. So people, the religious professionals, they can manage it. They can go without food or water from sunrise to sunset. But then they end up burdening other people who find it harder, and it's hard to get the exemptions that do exist. This is a dangerous passage for a pastor to stand up and preach on. I hope this is not your experience of religious professionals here at the Barge. I can see the yeast of the Pharisee beginning to work into my heart. But we fight to get this right at the Barge. We tried to get it right with the Sunday evening prayer meeting. Okay, so we decided as a staff team that we thought it would just be great to have another platform in which we could gather corporately together weekly and depend on God. The problem that Marcus raised was, well, that's just going to be that's great in theory, but getting people to come back out on a Sunday night when they've got a lot of other burdens on their plate, from work, from family, from the commute distance, that's going to be too big a burden. We've got to word it in a way that says, no, this is what we want to do in freedom, if you can. Not to say, no, real Christians are the ones that pitch up to the prayer meeting. The rest of you, let's say. No, real Christians are people that live before one master, who sees the burdens we're carrying, and do as we can. And in the end, Marcus was right. The burden was too big on people. People weren't coming, and so we've moved it to a staff-only prayer meeting on a Thursday afternoon. Hypocrites put on a performance, and then they burden others with the same thing. If our outward religiosity must be maintained, well, then it's not just ourselves we'll drag to church, we'll drag our spouse and our kids too, we'll put that burden on others. Or if we're fixated on looking good at work tomorrow, we'll burden others today by not putting our weight at home today. We'll burden others and we'll demand others perform. That's what's going on here in their reaction to Jesus. So in verse 38, they demand that Jesus perform the right ceremonial hand washing. They lay that burden on others. And verse 53 and 54 is just so pathetic. They can't find anything internally wrong with Jesus. He's good all the way down to the core. And so they have to try and provoke an external slip. They have to try and draw something on his mask, make him look bad. They provoke him to speak about many things, lying in wait for him to catch him in something he might say. They just go for the mask. They go for the outside. They can't take on the inside. Jesus unmasks hypocrisy in this passage. Jesus wants to help us see behind the mask. He wants us to be warned off hypocrisy within and to be warned away from hypocrites. Maybe you're not a Christian here today and you're looking in and you're kind of surprised, I guess. You think, well, I know that Jesus is going to challenge irreligion. I know that he's going to say, look, there's a God, we should be serving him, we need to come to him for forgiveness. You get that. But you're surprised to see Jesus with such strong words for what you thought was religion. But Jesus challenges this kind of religion too. If we can't articulate the difference between Jesus, true religion, and false religion, well, we'll forever be confused. We'll get put off Jesus because of something that he hates. Don't let that happen. Jesus hates false religion. Listen carefully to what Jesus says about true religion. We must beware hypocrisy. Why must we beware hypocrisy? Because of what hypocrites face. woe to hypocrites. So verse 40, Jesus says, you fools, Pharisee. Verse 42, woe to you, Pharisees. 43, woe to you, Pharisees. 44, woe to you. 45, a lawyer says, teacher, in saying these things, you insult us also. Well, woe to you too then. You've gone on burdening and burdening and burdening people and not lifting a little finger to help. Well, let me tell you about your burden too, hypocrite. Verse 48, you consent to the deeds of your fathers, for they killed the prophets, and you built their tombs. Listen to what the wisdom of God says about hypocrisy. I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute, so the blood of all the prophets shed from the foundation of the world may be charged, may be burdened on this generation. From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, from first prophet to last prophet, from A to Z, yes, I tell you, it will be required of this generation, Jesus says. This generation, the generation standing before Jesus, is the most culpable because they've seen the most and rejected the most. The previous generations were killing God's messengers. This generation are killing God's son. But the word generation in Greek can extend beyond simply one generation. It can apply to the whole race of people, the whole group of people who have had this heartbeat of hypocrisy in the past and extending forward into the future. It's a warning to anyone who ends up in this kind of hypocrisy. Jesus is saying hypocrites have placed massive burdens on others, and at the judgment on the last day, here is the massive burden that will fall upon them. I think in the first instance, Theophilus, Luke's friend who's reading this account, is actually supposed to rejoice when he hears these words. He may well have known that some of Jesus' apostles have been killed by religious hypocrites. And he's to rejoice to say, yeah, that was awful, that was wrong. God sees that and will deal with that. The case has come out recently, isn't it, of Archbishop Pell in Australia. At one point, the third highest ranking Catholic in the world as the treasurer of the Vatican. If the accusations prove true at the retrial, then they're trying to pursue, then he has been sexually abusive toward choir boys while preaching a hard line against sexual immorality and the use of condoms. Okay. The hypocrisy of it. God can bring down on the heads of hypocrites all that we sense should fall on them. But this is also a warning to disciples to make sure they flee hypocrisy. Don't get caught in that. If you feel that yeast, that leaven starting to work into your bit of the bread, flee. Get away from hypocrisy. 12:1. Beware, disciples, of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Nothing is covered up that will not be revealed on Judgment Day. Nothing that's hidden now will not be made known. Whatever we said in the dark will be heard in the light. A kind of interrogation spotlight will see past the mask that we put on if we're hiding greed and wickedness. What we've whispered so quietly in private rooms, well, that shall be proclaimed on the housetops. Woe to me if I preach about forgiveness and grace and don't believe my own need for it and don't hold it out to others. Woe to hypocrisy. Last thing, how do we escape hypocrisy? How do we escape it? This passage, verse 52, has got this intriguing little phrase about the key of knowledge. We're to use the key of knowledge. So, woe to you, lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering. What is the key of knowledge? We need it, right? Sounds important. Well, remember, these guys are interpreters of the Old Testament. So I think what they're doing is they've taken away the correct interpretation of the Old Testament. Maybe it's like a little door in a wall and the key you need to open it. See, when the lawyers came to the Old Testament and looked at its commands, all they saw was a list of rules. They saw something that said, okay, well, if you want to enter God's kingdom, you better get climbing. Climb that wall. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Honor your mother and father. Keep the Sabbath. Up and up and up they climb. You guys need to get climbing. But that's to not use the key of knowledge. To switch the illustration a little bit, think about the Rosetta Stone. You can go see it in the British Museum, or is it the British Library? Somewhere in London. The museum. Thanks for helping me out there. Write down the answer on the script. There were four languages on it, and because they knew some of the languages, they could suddenly decipher some of the other languages there. It was the key to knowledge, to reading rightly and understanding. I think the key to knowledge ultimately is humility. See, the command not to murder wasn't supposed to be read as a kind of, that's another grip on the wall to climbing in. The command not to murder was supposed to be read as a holistic command to not even murder or not even be angry with others. It wasn't a way to get in, it was a proof that we failed. We needed to love God with all our hearts, all our soul, all our mind, all our strength, love our neighbors as ourselves all of the time. It's a way of saying, look, the wall's too high. Look around for another entrance. Do we know we can't climb the wall by what we do? Will we be humble? Will we stoop low enough to the door to God's kingdom and knock on the door? And enter, Jesus says earlier on in the chapter, knock and the door will be open to you. The solution to hypocrisy is to use the key of knowledge. It is to love justice, mercy, and God's love. So the opposite of the Pharisee in this passage in front of us is someone in verse 41 who gives as alms, literally gifts of mercy, those things that are within. That's what will make us acceptable. Everything will be clean for us. In verse 41, what the Pharisee should have done is not neglect justice and the love of God. We can get to living justice, mercy, and God's love in a moment, but first off, we need to think about loving justice, mercy, and God's love. Justice, love, and mercy don't seem to hold together very well. If someone's been hypocritical, if they've burdened others, well, justice demands they themselves be burdened. But mercy says, give them a way out. For those of us who've been listening along and we've been thinking, oh man, hypocrisy is beginning to get to work in my heart. This is scary. What's the solution? I've been thinking that for myself. I was remembering an incident a couple of years ago. I was walking along the street with a non-Christian friend, and it's kind of early evening, and we passed three people who were absolutely blind drunk off their face, just lying on the pavement. And I instinctively, I just went, how do people get like that? And my non-Christian friend, who'd seen me at 16, said, what on earth are you talking about, Matt? I thought my mask was all shiny. He'd seen behind it. What are we going to do with our hypocrisy? Well, as we use the key of knowledge, we find humility helps us to read the sacrificial system in the Old Testament rightly. Sacrifice that animal. It wasn't another handhold on the climb into God's kingdom. It was the way to get into God's kingdom. It was the way of saying, you failed. You're a sinner. You need that animal to die in your place as a substitute, as a sacrifice. Jesus is the way in. He is the door into God's kingdom. The cross, at the cross, he dishes out justice on our failure, on our hypocrisy, and yet he can hold out mercy to failures like us. We're to love this. Jesus doesn't just bring justice to hypocrites. He holds out mercy and love. Those who love justice, mercy, and God's love will live justice, mercy, and God's love. So remember the words from Micah 6, verse 8. We are to do justly, we're to love mercy, and we're to walk humbly with our God. If we see God is like this, well, then we'll want to do this too. Holding this together is hard in everyday life. How do we hold together justice and mercy? Someone at the lunchtime talks was had a meeting with their boss's boss, and the boss's boss says, you're just too forgiving. Sort it out. Stop forgiving people. And the guy was processing that. He was going, well, I'm really happy, right? They can see that I am a forgiving person and that I love mercy. I'm ready to hold that out to others. But at the same time, I do need to hold to account the people who have failed and let down the company. I need to make sure that happens. There needs to be justice, but there needs to be mercy. How does that hold together? It will look different in every different situation, but we want to love these things and be ready to hold out these things to others. Jesus can expose hypocrisy. Jesus hates and will destroy hypocrisy. And yet there is rescue from hypocrisy. Let me lead us in a prayer as we close. Father, we want to own our failure before you. And own our sin. We want to own our hypocrisy, where we've seen that poking through. And we want to rejoice that you're a God of justice and mercy and love. Please help us to love you as you are and to be like you. In Jesus' name, amen.